Yeah, hello everybody. Thanks for the kind introduction and welcome to my talk on rendering FPGAs useless. Let's see how far we get on that. Very briefly on my group, it's called Novel Computing Technologies. We are working mostly on FPGA related issues, including CAD tools, reliability aspects, applications. We also make own FPGA chips. I had to talk about that last year, but we'll not talk about that one, sorry. We work on hardware security, which is the topic today. We work a lot on partial configuration. And if one fun project is that my postdoc achieved running a soft RISC-V CPU on an FPGA at 1001 megahertz, which is actually pretty cool. Yes. A little bit background and framing of the whole story. FPGAs are in these days available in cloud infrastructures. I wouldn't say it's at large scale, but they are there. And what's interesting with FPGAs is that you may be able to run your own design on it. And if you can run your own design on it, it's a question, can you do nasty things to the equipment there? Yeah. And when this whole wave with cloud FPGA started, it triggered a huge range of related work. And people in the good old days, they actually took their boards in their lab and then used, I don't know, oscilloscopes or measured electromagnetic radiation and all these things and tried to retrieve keys and so forth. And in these days, people mostly look into remote attacks. And what you can do on cloud FPGAs, I will talk a little bit. But before we start, a little bit FPGA background. So what is an FPGA? It's basically a grid of tiles that are somehow wired together. And these tiles, I call them configurable logic blocks. And what's in those configurable logic blocks is a little bit hardware infrastructure to accomplish switching. So I can switch different components together, and the logic itself is created just by lookup tables, which is the easiest form of function generators. It's just a tiny memory where you say for a couple of input bits what the result should be. And the example here shows that I have an input A, and if the input A is zero, my output here is zero, and if my input A is one, then the input B gets toggled to the output. So a zero becomes a one, and a one becomes a zero. And then I take this output and feed it back to this input B. And that forms exactly a ring oscillator. Yeah, and we examined how fast you can spin this ring oscillator, and you can do a lot of nasty things with such ring oscillators, which I will show you in the following. One of it is that the speed of a ring oscillator depends on its operational temperature and the supply voltage. Temperature usually changes slowly, supply voltage may change pretty fast. And what you see here is a ring oscillator. I have this block in here, which is not really important, but if I want to deploy such a ring oscillator on Amazon Web Services, this would be rejected. They will scan for such ring oscillators, but I can just include a transparent latch. And if I enable this transparent latch, this basically behaves like a wire, and then it passes the design rule check, and I can deploy it. Yeah, and that thing spins actually pretty fast, something like 1.6 gigahertz or so, 1.8 depending on which one you use. And then you want to measure the speed pretty accurately. And the easy trick for that one is a time-to-digital converter. The trick here is that you use the delay on this wiring here, and you sample it in parallel. And then you have basically something like an activity wave that travels down this road, and you can sample it in parallel, and you get pretty good accuracy. We talk usually about less than 10 picoseconds. It's easy to achieve. Yeah, and so you have basically a temperature and most importantly voltage-dependent sensor, and you can measure the speed of this ring oscillator. And if you want so, that's something like a remote oscilloscope. And people use this, for example, to detect or did side channel analysis on something like AES, DES cores, and the usual suspects. And this works pretty good. But however, I would say this is more in an industry, it's an academic setting, not so much for industry a problem. Okay. On the deny of service attacks, one thing you can do is, this is like what you see in the figure, is you can create short circuits. And what the figure shows you is basically how multiplexer is physically implemented. You have so-called pass transistors or transmission gate. There are different ways to construct these things. And if you control the transistor with a one, it basically switches the input here to the output. Yeah, and then the way how this works is that I have column selects, like this column, of I have three columns, and I usually select only one, and then I will pick one row, and that routes my input signal to the output. So what you see here is a 12-input multiplexer. And usually you have a one-hot encoded signal to pick one specific column, and a one-hot signal to pick a specific row. And, well, if you activate multiple inputs at the same time, and you drive some inputs 1 and some inputs 0, you basically create a short. And I actually accidentally created this one when I was playing with low-level things and created my bitstreams on my own, and I actually damaged a chip. And this is why I started this whole research and looked into what was actually happening there and tried to what was going on. And what I managed was then on a Spartan 3 FPGA, if I actually activate all inputs, so I basically put all the configuration bits to 1 and then apply a specific input pattern, I could measure up to 7 milliamps extra. 7 milliamps doesn't sound like a lot, but you have an awful amount of lookup tables, like hundreds of thousands eventually, and they have multiple of these inputs. Yeah. So it would add up. Okay. Other things what you can do is, well, you can build a shift register, very simple. And you just take, on a data center FPGA, you have something like 20, 30 million flip-flops, and you can initialize them 1010 in a ring shift, and then you shift at half a gigahertz, and that's usually something like 2 kilowatts or so. So it's a lot. And you can control this, and this is actually a nasty one, so you can basically increase load steps on a per cycle base. And that may create voltage drops, for example. And this is something that you can also use for an attack. Think of you would have implemented a soft CPU, and you have a compare instruction, right? And you make the voltage a little bit less by activating this attack. Then you could insert a fault by, for example, not giving the circuit enough time to set the flag that a corresponding branch will eventually go in the wrong direction. You get the idea. Another fun one is glitch amplification. This is just a toggle flip-flop, and it should only demonstrate that I have a point here that toggles each clock cycle. That's everything I want to say. And if I route that signal to an XOR with different latencies, each time my signal arrives at the XOR, it will toggle the output. And that allows me to generate faster switching activity than I have here at the input side. So if my signal is not fast enough, I can go faster just by glitch amplification. Yes. And okay, I can make this short. You got the idea. This one here is not possible because I don't get direct access to the bitstream, so I have to manipulate this basically on my own. All the other ones can be deployed, and yeah, it's difficult to protect against. Then we started looking into all kinds of ring oscillators because they are nasty, to see how fast can they spin, because fast ones are specifically good for sidechain analysis and eventually also for power draw. And we saw that most are equal, but there is this guy that is a bit more equal. And it spins at around about 6 gigahertz, which is for an FPGA reasonably fast. However, we found that slower ones are also can draw substantial power. So what you see on this axis is how much power they draw, and we did this for 2,000 ring oscillators in parallel, so to better be able to better measure the impact, and we get something like 2 milliwatts per lookup table, or 60 milliwatts for a cluster of 8, which is called CLB. Okay. If you want to create fast oscillators, we basically have to see how we get the fastest routing path and how we get the fastest path through the lookup table, which is the thing that implements us the inverter. that we need, and basically the frequency of a ring oscillator is basically reciprocal to this to the latency that we have. And if you look at such a lookup table, how they are physically implemented, it's basically a multiplexer tree. And if I switch something at this point, it has to traverse all the way through the lookup table, but if I go on that one, it goes a little bit faster. And the 6 GHz oscillator that you saw is exactly using this red path in the bottom, which is just 41 picoseconds from input to output. And this one has also the characteristic that I find a super fast path from the output here back to this input. And that gives you, 6 GHz. But there are other ways to do this. There are multiplexes in the user logic you can use. You can use the carry chain logic. You have DSP blocks that you can use. You can have transparent latches. You can use asynchronous or synchronous resets. Asynchronous resets you need for self-running oscillators. This is my glitch amplification. This is my personal favorite. So what you do is you have a toggle flip-flop, and you route once directly to the XOR, once with a little bit delay. You take the output, feed it back to your clock input, and if you trigger once, kick it off, it spins at round about 0.5 GHz and burns actually quite some power. Okay. To give you an idea how much power that actually is, we did a very simple experiment, and that was just filling a chip with ring oscillators and see when it starts to crash or when we saturate the power envelope that we have or budget. Yeah, and this is a simple, it looks almost like, Raspberry Pi-like board, but it's with an FPGA on. And what we did was just here ramping up the amount of lookup tables available with ring oscillators and see how this impacts the total power. And the board is designed for something like 11 watts maximum power delivery. And we get this with just 3% of the lookup tables. Yeah, and well, there are still 97 to go. You get the idea. Okay, question, can we spin faster? 6 GHz is a lot, but you can go actually faster. We got a little bit over 8 GHz once. The way you do that one is you can overclock the clock generators a little bit, and you get phase shifters inside your clock managers. So for more advanced designs, you have to eventually work with multiple clocks, and you need special phase relationships and so forth. And the chip provides you, for that one, phase shifters. And what we do is we run basically a fast clock, and we have multiple of those, and then we phase align them in a way that they are offset as shown in the figure. If we then route this to an XOR gate, we get again glitch amplification, and each phase, so if we have 4 phases, I get 4 times the base frequency. Yeah, and if I get to something like 2-ish GHz, I get my 8 GHz at the output. Yeah, and so you can actually spin faster than the fastest clock or fastest ring oscillator you get. And then what we did was copy and paste as a hard macro. It's not too important to understand the figure, but what it shows is that this thing here, this XOR, I basically connected it as kind of a hard macro, and this hard macro was copied across the chip at multiple locations. That means wherever I have this hard macro, I have an 8 or 6 GHz signal popping up. And then I use this one to connect wires to it and measure how much extra power do I draw if I drive wires with a certain frequency. And that's this plot here in the bottom. And there are different wire categories, so we did this for the different wires individually. You saw also some outliers here. This relies a little bit because it depends on the duty cycle of your phase shifting that you do. You can manipulate it. But what you kind of see is that there is kind of a peak, and further down the road, power actually goes down, which is to some extent expected, because what happens is if you ramp the speed up of your oscillators, you will your voltage swing will go down. And if your voltage swing goes down, then the charge and discharge energy that you lose will go down too. Yeah, so this all fits. Yeah, but if you just make a rough estimate, and this is by far not complete, you burn something like 2 kilowatts on just the oscillators, maybe 5 kilowatts on wires. If you would take the entire resources available, maybe 2 extra kilowatts on the flops. And there are still some gimmicks like the block RAMs, DSP block, gigabit transceivers to go. Okay, so we thought, it's time to think about running experiments on a data center card. And what we did was designed not something super specific or spectacular. It's 10% of the FPGA resources are used just of the lookup tables, and we draw 350 watts with them. But we did a design that passes all design rule checks that we can deploy that design on Amazon. And so it's basically easy to generate a design that has kilowatts of power hammering potential, as we call that. So these things pass the design rule checks. And to give you an idea how much this is the sun emits 36 megawatts per square meter, which equates to 6.3 kilowatts per square centimeter. So the energy density that we have is not as dense as the sun surface, but it's in the same order of magnitude, which is okay. Okay. Then we contacted actually Amazon, and it took me quite some time before I got my very first response. And I wrote them something like, we tested a tax on Alveo U200, which is, by the way, the same specification as what you get in Amazon. And then we said, we have designs that can burn a few kilowatts of power when using enough resources. And then I asked them if we should collaborate together and see what we can do about this. And then they told me, Dirk, you may run whatever tests you'd like. Okay. Then I wrote back, if you guys give me permission to attack F1, we will do so. So if you feel confident, please allow us running experiments on your equipment. The answer was, I haven't made up the smiley. Okay, so next step, running experiments on Amazon. If you go on Amazon, everything is virtualized. So you are not, you don't know really to which instance you are talking. There is no IP address, a MAC address, or anything like that. But we have an FPGA. That's all we need. So what we did is basically, we deployed ring oscillators. This thing is nothing else than a ring oscillator. And we let the ring oscillator run for some time, and we count. And the point is that we use is that due to process variation, some of these oscillators run a little faster or a little slower. And that is device depending. Yeah, it's a little bit noise if you want so. And this is exactly what we implemented on an Amazon chip. This is basically how the design looked like. This is something that you get from Amazon. This is what we added to control the whole thing, to heat it up here and there a little bit. And these are our PUFs, physical unclonable functions, to basically fingerprint the chip. And to give you an idea how this works is, here I have 2 PUF responses at different temperature levels. So we heated up the chip, so you know to which chip you are talking, and you know if the chip was in use before or not. You can basically get the temperature, and the gray one on top is just as a reference, a reading from a different PUF. So now we know to which FPGA we talk. Of course, this is not an exact measurement. You have to correlate it at the end of the day, but that's trivia. Okay, now we know to whom we talk. Let's do the power hammering. Before we do this or dive into this, let's look a little bit how FPGAs are secured at Amazon. And the first thing is that they run design rule checks on it. Which, by the way, implies that you as a user give your design to Amazon. There is something what they call encrypted design checkpoint, but this is very poor obfuscating. This design checkpoint still contains all your original names, including hierarchy of your design. So this is still really revealing quite a lot. Then bitstreams themselves, they are always generated by Amazon. so you will never see your own bitstream, and the configuration is done through a hypervisor API, so you never touch the FPGA bitstream on your own. And even if you run the whole chip, they do some online monitoring on the power consumption, and that was our first experiment working out how this power monitoring actually works. And what we did in our lab was the following, and that is, we have a free-running oscillator, again, something that can be deployed on Amazon. We scale this down a little bit, and then we use this to fill a shift register, one after the other, and to each shift register output, we have a power waster connected. So in other words, over time, we are gradually ramping up the power consumption. So I can look at my stopwatch to know how much power the chip is currently burning. Then we calibrated this whole thing in our lab, and then we sent it to Amazon. And at 85 watts, if you deploy that, you get a warning from the system. And then, well, at 105 watts, they actually gate your clock. So the FPGA is still working, but they switch off your clock. But I don't care, because I generate my own one. then at something like 100-ish plus watts, they actually cut you from the device. Sometimes we lost even contact to the instance itself, but in many cases, you just lose contact to the FPGA itself. Okay, so it's something like you can deploy, let's say, up to 100-ish watts. Then we said, okay, let's do a little more than that. So what we did is basically we launch an instance, we do the fingerprinting with our puffs, and then eventually we crash them with 360 watts. So we wanted to do something where we make a statement but don't create real harm. And the result of that one was, if we don't crash, we basically see the instance. So the way what we did is, we continuously request instances, release them, to just query what instances are available. And each time we do this fingerprinting. And if we don't crash, we basically get them back pretty much instantaneously, or in a few minutes. And if we crash, well, this is in minutes, it takes something like an hour or a few hours. I'm not sure if somebody with a trolley has to pop by and restart the whole thing. They never told me, yeah, but that's what we observed. And we did this for 100 instances, and then they... this is how far we got before they switched off our account. anyway. Okay. Now, and interestingly, after that, they had a lot of time for us. So the email was a little longer that we got. And actually, they took this quite serious. And I was also in contact with Xilinx, and we got bots donated from Xilinx to Fry. And as they're also interested in what can you do if you push this a little bit. Yes, and so we tried playing hotspot design, because the real problem is not deploying kilowatts of power, because there is some overpower logic that will basically kick in and protect your chip. So that's not really the deal breaker. It is more like if I deploy 100 watts on the tip of a needle. Yeah, and then is the question, can something like that fry the chip? Yeah, and in order to work out what happens in the chip, well, we don't have a microscope, right? I can't investigate. So what we did is basically we thought of how to measure latency of the things on your chip. And usually the speed of your chip is defined by the time it takes between two flip-flops on your data path, or the logic that you have, and routing and so forth, basically between two flops. And that latency between those two flops defines how fast you can spin your circuit. So if I do it in a way that these two clocks here, that I can use two different clocks that I can phase shift against each other, I can define how much time I have on this path. And what we really do to measure latency is, we toggle a signal from, let's say, from 0 to 1. And then I sample it with a time-shifted clock. And if the time is long enough, well, I sample my 0000. At one point, it starts flickering, and eventually, I just have stable ones. Okay, so and the way to do this is you get clock managers on the chip, and if you cascade this in a clever way, you get a phase shift accuracy of round about a picosecond, which is a lot. And we use this one to characterize the chip. Then, in order to drive maximum power, we used again a ring oscillator. We use basically all possible outputs that we can get. We use the latches, everything. If we route the signal through other lookup tables to get maximum fan out to really drive this high 6 gigahertz or something through everything you have on the chip, we go through other lookup tables at the input that is rippling through most of the stages. So we played a little bit around with this design to maximize power consumption. And then, well, that gives us around about 100 milliwatts per CLB. If you would scale that one up, this would be something like 15 kilowatts. And again, DSP blocks and block RAMs and everything is still there. I will not talk too much about aging mechanisms. There are some aging mechanisms that just happen over time. There are some that are related if you drive a constant signal through your transistors, and some are related to basically operating the chip hot, and you will basically kick out some of your charge carriers into your gate oxide, which is the insulation layer in your transistor, not important. And if you drive high current over an excessive time at high temperature, you actually move metal inside the chip, which is called electron migration. And we played with different attack scenarios to look into different of these aging techniques. I don't have time to tell you everything, all the findings, but if we examine basically difference between rising and falling edge, it's just that the transistors that you have two types of transistors and they age differently. So we investigated that one. And what you see is we run experiments for usually 2-3 weeks, and just after day two, we saw already a jump in delay in the range of 0.3 picoseconds or so. However, this aging was not equally distributed. Most of the wires don't age or age just a little bit, but a few of them are quite outliers. Yeah, but however, they are not fried so far. And this aging eventually gets better over time, so the chip can recover or self-heal if you want so. Okay, some results. I haven't said that. This result was on a smaller FPGA with something like, I don't know, 20-ish watts or something. And then we thought, okay, and I thought already this will fry the chip. But then we went onto a data center FPGA all in, and we created a 135-watt hotspot in just 1.2%. And we tortured the chip over 3 weeks. And the average performance degradation we saw was 1.39%, which doesn't sound like a lot, but interestingly, again, the distribution was very wide. And some wires, just like very few, aged by 70%. Yeah, but they are still alive. Yeah. But we had only very few wires that age like more than 50%. What does this all mean in practice? So in reality, if you have a path aged, this alone will not make everything slower, because on the critical path, you will have multiple of these paths usually. This is what makes it critical. And if only one is a terribly slow outlier, it will impact you only to some extent. Yeah. And point one. Point two is not all your paths in your design are critical. So if you have a non-critical path on something that is slow, it may not actually bite you. And I think in reality, it's probably something like the performance reduction we got is something like 15 to 20-ish in Fmax that you get, which would mean if I have a 500 megahertz design, it could only operate safely at 425 or 400 megahertz, something like that. This one I will only go very briefly through because my time is running out. We did something, we are not only destructive people killing chips, we did something like a virus scanner where you can put in your bitstream and we can basically reverse the bitstream, so get back to a netlist and then analyze it. Doing these kinds of things, yeah, and this is basically how it works. You get your bitstream in, we can get to something like a netlist and then analyze that one if you have ring oscillators or other nasty circuits. Yeah, we have also something, if you have done this, you can actually compute something like a glitch score. For example, if I go to an AND gate, I may have less switching activity than if I route through an XOR XNOR gate. And so we can estimate how much switching activity my current circuit has. Also, I can put this together with the wires that I drive and correlate this with the area. And then I get these wonderful, nice heat maps. And we did this, for example, for Bitcoin miner bit streams that you can download on the internet. And this is how we do the scan. OK, very briefly discussion. As my time runs out. So damaging FPGAs is much harder than I thought. I would have bet a crate of beer that 20 watts will do already the trick, and even with 100 watts, it didn't do the trick. One of the reasons is probably that an FPGA has a lot of dark silicon, meaning you have a large number of multiplexes that are pretty big, and throughout your multiplex, you only have one path that you route through, and the rest is sitting idle. You have a lot of SRAM cells that you need to store the configuration, and all these ingredients, they don't switch. Yeah, and this is basically helping the chip to survive. Also, silicon is an incredibly good heat spreader. Yes, but we still have some ideas. And if somebody here in the audience has an idea, please ping me after the talk. Aging is severe, and the aging that we achieved on data center FPGAs is probably just about enough to render them useless, that you can't rent them out. And however, good news is those situations can be spotted through scanning, and there are lots of recommendations we did to AWS, like scanning through a trusted entity so that you don't have to wield your design to Amazon. Better scans, of course. We have a few ideas on that one. And there are lots of things in the infrastructure, so you should, for example, not give anybody access to your clock trees and so forth. Okay, that's pretty much all I have to say. I have a little bit advertisement. If you like to make chips and haven't done this before, we run a summer school for a few years now, which is called HiChips. And what you see here in the bottom right is the chip that is currently put together and will be taped out in a few months or in 2-3 months. And if you like this, come to us. We do chips entirely with open source tools, A to Z, and that will be actually taped out. Then we have a set up a FOSSI meetup. You will find this also in your event list. So for all the guys who look into or are interested in FPGAs, ASICs, hardware, and so forth, let's gather after this call, talk later. Okay, that's it. I just want to say thanks to Badia, Joe, and Kaspar, who basically did all the work that I present here.
Thank you very much. So, we have a bit more than 5 minutes for questions. We have microphones in the hall, so if you would line up behind the microphones if you have questions. Then, on stream, if you have questions, we have the IRC channel on HackIn, that is 393C Hall Fuse, or the Matrix channel, Hall Fuse. You can ask your questions online. Also, of course, the speaker is probably going to be available after for questions. You sounded like that. Anyway, let's start over here on microphone one.
Hi, thanks for the talk. It was very interesting.
Come closer.
Thanks for the talk. Mm-hmm. It was very interesting. And so back in the beginning, you told us that the ring oscillator frequency basically depends on the delay and the voltage supply. Mm-hmm. But does it also depend on the load the ring oscillator has to drive?
Yes. That's actually an interesting one. And something, it depends how the switch matrix how the switch matrices are implemented, and the usual way with path and transmission gates would mean the higher my fan out, the more I have to drive, and then it would get slow. Yes, it is something. But if you know that, you will, well, drive exactly the ring oscillator in one point where you tap in. And even this tap in, you could do this as you have a secondary output on your lookup table eventually that you can also use. So you could end up with just a single fan out or fan out of one. But yes, the impact is there.
Thanks.
Okay, next question is from the internet, please.
The internet wants to know, you tested the FPGA power consumption by ramping up. Did you try to do it a faster way, and what happened?
So when I did the 350 watts, this was just switch it on. And the ramping up thing, I think this was something like 24-ish. Hold on. No, it was just before, sorry. The ramping up here, this was basically just to see what the impact is and how Amazon behaves if I ramp up. But for the attack itself, we did an all-in. Actually, there's a fun one I haven't said. People did this flickering with large load steps, and you have some power regulation circuitry. And your power regulator circuitry may have some resonance frequency. It's around about at a few tens, maybe a few hundreds of kilohertz. So you sweep through, and eventually you trigger that one. And people did this experiment, of course. Yeah, nobody has seen a power overshot, so that you say that my power regulator freaks out and blows out a little bit too much voltage. That doesn't happen, but people saw, for example, cold or freezing of the power regulation circuit, which may require a cold start, which is, of course, in a data center setting, a no-go.
Thank you very much. Now, microphone two, all the way in the back.
Quick question, because those attacks seem to be quite damaging for the cloud providers and et cetera, and I wanted to ask how to get started.
So the damaging, are you talking about damaging the chip?
Yeah, for example.
If you are lucky, you get a cheap board on eBay. Actually, there are a lot of leftovers that have been used for Bitcoin mining. They are already well conditioned for aging. so they are usually a little bit worn out. But that's it fundamentally. The point is, I work on partial configuration before, and I know all the bitstream encoding, a lot of architectural details. I know the architecture graph. So if I'm looking for a path, I write few lines of Python to find that path. Yeah. So if you want to do a little bit more, I can't release everything publicly. The bitstream encoding, Google for Project U-Ray or Project X-Ray. You will find the bitstream encoding, most of it. We know a little bit more, but you get 80, 90 plus percent. So that's a way to start.
Okay, thank you.
Microphone one, please.
Did you take a look at the shift register mode of the LUTMs to increase the pairing of SRAM cells? Did it work?
So when I said we have like 20, 30 million of the flops, this implied already using the SLR shift registers. Yes, exactly those ones. Yeah, and as I said, you need, if you have 15,000 bits that toggle, that was north of 2 kilowatts already. Of course, I'm not able to run it. What I do is instead of whatever I said, 15, I use like a percent of that one, and then I scale it basically up. Yes.
Next question, microphone two, please.
Yeah, have you tried tricking the power measuring circuitry, like you use a high peak power but with a low duty cycle, so that the devices measure a low average power but have a high peak power, which will then create hotspots which will damage the FPGA?
We haven't done it in that way, and for the hotspot, this is actually a very temperamental one. So we. One thing I also haven't had time to tell, if your chip runs hotter, the ring oscillator spins faster. On more modern process nodes, they run faster, and it depends how your circuit looks like, but they can run substantially faster, and we saw like a thermal runaway, and this was shooting through the roof. However, it was soon exceeding the maximum power budget that I had, so we had to make the hotspot smaller and smaller and smaller in area while keeping the power basically at a high power. And if I configure from one hotspot to another, if I don't do that partially in a proper way, the chip will cool down. So for the hotspot, you want to go all in, but you may trick actually Amazon to squeeze out a little bit more than your allowed power consumption. If this works, I don't know, but I love the idea.
Thank you very much. Unfortunately, we are out of time, so give another warm round of applause to Dirk.